vehicle is called to your home address, or if it's, you know, and what it's for. Because often those codes were very specific about, you know, this was a heart attack, this was a poisoning, this was some sort of violent altercation or domestic violence dispute or things like that. And so trying to figure out ways to sort of distinguish between what are single-family homes, what are commercial spaces, what are multi-unit buildings, and how do you I think what the city ended up doing, in that case at least, was to scrub it to the hundreds block. So rather than a precise address, it was on this hundreds block of the neighborhood. Others due to intersection points. We've seen also to a general neighborhood zone, or you can introduce more sophisticated technologies to sort of create query interfaces where you, or sort of heat maps and things like that, where you can't get down to an individual address, and therefore you're providing a little bit more protection for the individual, but you are also helping people get access to that very valuable information. So that's I think, a good example there.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great example. I appreciate that.
And so we took that into account. We took sort of these competing public policy goals. We looked at the city's commitment to individual privacy and to useful and open data. And we looked at sort of the privacy foundations on which Seattle and other open data programs, frankly, were operating, and we put them together into methodology. And so some of the things that we were looking at included the Washington Public Records Act, which is has quite a thumb on the scale in favor of releasing data, even if there is personally... So Washington's public record law has a thumb on the scale in favor of release of information, at least from the privacy perspective. So even if there is personally identifiable information, in many cases it can still go out if there is a public policy rationale.
We recently had an issue come up involving Washington public records laws and a public records request that was made to get Portland information in Washington. So this very question was framed, and the judge took a look at both Oregon law and Washington law and ultimately concluded that the information sought should not be disclosed for a variety of public policy reasons. We were sharply criticized by an editorial page for going through that exercise. But one of the things that I learned is that I would still rather have a judge balance those equities rather than have someone make that call and get the wrong outcome. And I don't think we should be shy about using tribunals that are independent to, again, balance the interest that the public has of a right to know versus privacy concerns and ultimately render a decision. And quite surprisingly, even the Washington judge agreed with the city of Portland. So the privacy interests of the person that was raising the objection were very strong.
Yeah, and it's a difficult question, and a lot of it goes back to some of these laws being written before the era of these widespread sort of data sets being available, and so the ease with which you can re-identify an individual or you can create a harm based on somebody's personally identifiable information hasn't necessarily been captured in some of the state and local laws or even some of the federal ones, just given the pace of technology these days. So it's a very difficult question and a very live issue, clearly. So we looked at the Public Records Act and we looked at the City of Seattle's citywide public privacy principles as sort of these were their commitments to the public about what they would or would not do and how sort of the general ethos around privacy and how they would protect it. And so that was sort of one of our foundational pieces in building this risk assessment. We also looked at studies that the University of Washington had done with the Seattle IT team, which owned privacy. We looked at we met with the Community Technology Advisory Board, a group of citizens who help advise on these issues. We did a public comment period. We talked with city staff and looked at other research in the area. And what we ultimately did was we identified three key risks for the open data program, that risk of re-identification, that issues around data quality, so making sure that if data are incomplete or inaccurate, so if you are incorrectly represented in a DUI database, that can have a really big impact on your life. So helping them think through the review process for that, and then thinking through issues around public trust. So if you do create a privacy harm, or if you're perceived that there might be privacy harms, there was a real concern that people would stop using city services, that they would lie and provide false information to protect their privacy and do these sort of protective measures, or that you could just have community pushback on the idea of open data at all, and again, sort of broader city efforts around smart cities. So I have been going for quite some time. So I'm going to leave it at that, I think. And so those were the key risks. We did some assessment, and happy to talk about that in more detail if there's questions, but also just to point folks towards where that report went.
I'm particularly interested in the issue of re-identification, which I just Googled, to be honest. Hopefully I won't start getting ads on Facebook for hacking tools. Kind of self-explanatory, but it's the ability to take information that has been aggregated and the identifying factors taken away and then re-identify the individual that data is attached to.
Yes.
So you have it as a key open data privacy risk. What has your approach been to this issue?
So it's tough. Part of our approach is telling folks that, so there's been a bundle of techniques people have been used to protect against re-identification for a while. These are also becoming outdated as technology advances, as statistical and mathematical tools advance. And so there's a variety of tools that are emerging now that we're recommending. A large part of our report was a recommendation in investing in those, and they're called differential privacy is particularly the one there. I think, the only way that you can have a mathematically measurable proof against that privacy has been protected and against that information leaking or personally identifiable information leaking. But also a large part of it was just helping think through what's the value of any particular data field, what's the impact if it's removed, if it's aggregated or perturbed in some way. So rather than reporting a date of birth, you report a year of birth, or you report a range of years, or techniques like that that people have. And then helping create more consistent use of those tools across the city departments.
And then my other concern is around the use of this data for surveillance of activists, because we know in the city of Portland that has happened before, and it's happened illegally. And I don't have a nuanced enough understanding of this issue to imagine how it could be exploited for that use.
That's actually a great segue into introducing Brian.
Oh,
Heather,
you're welcome.
Perhaps was going to be with us today. You have one last question.
Do you mind? Yeah,
no,
not
at all.
I just found the PowerPoint and the presentation so compelling. I just want to do a disclaimer first. I have an Apple computer at home. I use a smartphone, and I take Lyft. And my kids think that I'm a dinosaur in terms of technology. And probably some of my critics think I'm a Luddite. So I just want to put that out there. And I also want to say that if I could be king for a day, we would never have a policy that begins with the word smart. Two things about doing that. Number one, it's just off-putting. It's presumptuous. I know it's not your idea. I'm just saying I wish we didn't do it. And number two, it implies that anyone that has these concerns about privacy, equity, budget concerns must be in favor of dumb cities. Because, of course, the opposite of a smart city is a dumb city. So these are really dumb concerns. And I hate the branding. And I will tell you, I've actually, though, been persuaded to call every new initiative that I bring to council the Smart Something Initiative. Because what it means is we back into it and we start funding it before we've actually looked at it, because none of us want to be accused of being dumb. So, but that with that getting, I just need to get that off my chest.
We'll start doing that.
I am very concerned about the privacy and collection of data issue that you've raised. And one of the things about smart cities is we're talking about putting up monitors and sensors all over the place to collect a lot of data, and ultimately with the goal, which I hope we never get to, of autonomous vehicles. So that's a lot of information, and I think it's unlikely we would be collecting that information with autonomous vehicles without knowing what the vehicle is and who's the operator and the owner. I mean, so we're going to have this is going to come up repeatedly. I made the mistake over the weekend of somehow, when I disabled my phone on the airplane trip I took to New York, I somehow activated location services. Now, location services is sort of a first cousin of what we're talking about. And I started getting emails in Jackson Heights, Queens, unsolicited, suggesting places that I go for a restaurant. Well, I mean, I appreciate the gesture, but it is really shocking. I mean, the only person that I, other than my wife, that I would like to know that I'm in Jackson Heights, Queens, is my bank. But even my bank will send me a text if they have a concern, and I can shut off my card because they're seeing activity in Jackson Heights and they're wondering, if is that me or is that someone who's stolen my data? So what you're raising about privacy issues, and the one thing, and I'm glad we're going to move to Oakland, because the one concern I have is that you have framed the provocative questions that we have to ask as policymakers. But we don't do so well at 30,000 foot. You know, we can have these debates about, well, on the one hand and the other, and we can get very lawyerly and very philosophical. But we do much better when they're bright lines. And we do really well when we get a report that is coded in yellow, green, and red, because then it's inescapable. So what I'm hoping that we learn from Oakland is some bright lines. Of ways that we make decisions where someone's coming to us and saying, this is an unacceptable risk because, rather than us having, you know, big high-level debates, because as you said, you can get different outcomes depending on who's at the table, what you value, how you structure the debate. And that means that we don't really have a guidepost. We have an issue spotting. We know to issue spot, but we don't have a guidepost, and I'm hoping Oakland's experience gives us some of those guideposts. But thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner. That is a great segue to introducing Brian. Heather Patterson was going to be here. I had a phone conversation with her, and she is as interesting and fascinating as I'll see. And I could have talked to either of them for days, but she was ill today. So Brian is actually from Oakland, has been very involved in the development of the city's privacy commission and the way that they're doing business there. So he's here on the phone.
Caller, are you there? Hello, are you there? Are you there?
Yep.
Okay.
Okay. Are you ready for me to take over the screen?
Yeah.
What is that? Oh.
Oh, somebody has to turn it off. Sharing on their end.
Are you ready?
Lots of keys are being pressed. I think we're quickly on our way.
Yeah. All right. You can go. Ryan, you can go.
Okay. So you're going to run the slides for me?
Yes, we are going to do
that. Okay. Great. Well, I'm Brian Hofer. I'm chair of the Privacy Commission, and I'm filling in for Heather. Due to her illness. I've been involved with this since the very beginning, led the fight to create the commission. We did previously have a temporary commission. It all started out with the Domain Awareness Center, which hit the city council agenda in July 2013. For those of you that remember, Edward Snowden hit the headlines in June of 2013. And in Oakland, Occupy had recently ended. There was also some, you know, police brutality issues going on. So it's kind of a perfect storm in Oakland. They hit us without any notice with a $12 million proposed citywide surveillance system. They were going to aggregate license plate readers, shot spotter, facial recognition, over 700 cameras, data sharing with federal partners, and link it all into this really big server where they could apply analytics to it. And out of that, a large citizen coalition formed to oppose the project. I got involved in 2014, and in March of 2014, we were able to scuttle the project. And out of that vote came a decision to create a temporary Citizens Privacy Commission. At that point in Oakland, we had no privacy policies at all. Our unwritten policy was just do whatever we want, retain data for as long as we want. Our police got embarrassed that their license plate server crashed due to the ridiculous 5 to 6 years worth of retention that they had kept. So we were kind of like the Wild West, unregulated, so to speak. The ad hoc convinced the city council to create a standing privacy commission. Each city council member gets to appoint one member. The mayor also appoints one member. And our first task was to come up with a framework, a vetting mechanism for all the technology that was soon to come our way, not just necessarily from law enforcement, but also smart city proposals from private vendors. And that's actually what we've been seeing first, is more of the non-law enforcement stuff coming to us. We follow the ACLU CCOPS model, community control over policing surveillance, which is something that I've personally been involved in around the greater Bay Area. Six jurisdictions have currently made it law. Unfortunately, only Oakland has a privacy commission. We're trying to get that in place in other jurisdictions as well, because it really goes hand in hand with the framework. It provides a lot more public notice, a lot more input for the public and the staff to really weigh the pros and cons of these proposals, to really drill down into the details and to create good use policies for the responsible use of this equipment. It allows us to educate the elected officials. Almost no elected official I've ever talked to has any idea what this equipment and the technology can do. And so it's really helped us get involved there. These enumerated list that you see right here, this is from our formation ordinance. This is what our duties are. Number two is the big one. That's the surveillance ordinance, the framework. It applies to all equipment that meets our definition. It requires that we conduct an impact analysis and write a use policy for it. And we also comment on local legislation, look at our retention schedule, business practices that collect data, and that type of thing. And so we're an advisory body to the city council. Every single item we've touched has received or recommended has received a unanimous yes vote from the city council. And I think that's proof that this is a really pragmatic and useful model, because we do all the hard work before we get to be elected. We've been able to get the staff buy-in. We've been able to educate people, as I mentioned, and really write a tight use policy that allows the equipment to be used and also mitigate concerns at the same time. You can go to the next slide, please. Yeah, so this, what's strange is that we started this conversation in 2014. We're actually one of the last ones to pass the ordinance. So we've sort of informally been operating this way. And I go around to other cities and say, basically, don't do what Oakland did. You know, put the framework in place first, set the stuff first, instead of just trying to force it on the public and then worry about privacy later. And so ours just passed in the late spring. You can see our definition there of surveillance technology. It's different than Seattle, which some of you are probably familiar with. We did our very best to future-proof it. For all the things that are, you know, coming our way that we don't even know yet. How the open ordinance is different than the other ones, including the ACLU model, is that we have a prohibition on non-disclosure agreements, and we have additional whistleblower protection. So that's why we call it the gold standard. We think it's a little bit better. And it also just has the benefit of the privacy commission.
Could I ask a question on that
last
point? Yep. I'm sorry to interrupt. This is Mayor Ted Wheeler. Thank you so much for joining us today. We sure appreciate it. My question was on the non-disclosure agreements. Was that simply related to the commission itself, or is that a citywide policy that no elected officer or other official of the city will sign a non-disclosure agreement? I wasn't clear on that.
It's citywide. So no city agent, whether that's an elected official or staff, can enter into a non-disclosure agreement.
And that is currently the policy of the city?
Yes.
Interesting. Thank you.
It's a law, not just a policy. It's in the ordinance itself.
That wouldn't work very well for Superfund, would it?
What's that?
We've got a few sensitive things going on in the city of Portland, particularly with related to various cleanups, etc., that
yeah.
It's kind of crucial to not have that in it?
Well, a non-disclosure agreement, just to be clear, based on my understanding, is not meant to abrogate the attorney-client privilege, right?
No, and this, I mean, this is just a little snippet that Heather wrote in. What the real language in the ordinance says is we cannot enter into a non-disclosure agreement that attempts to interfere with the intent of the ordinance. So I'll use the real-world example, Stingray, the cell phone tracker. Harris and the FBI at one point were requiring law enforcement to enter into a non-disclosure agreement. Folks were, I believe, misinterpreting the agreement, but they were not discussing the equipment or refusing to even discuss the model or the maker or its capabilities with the elected officials. That would be defeating the intent of the surveillance ordinance, so they could not enter into that type of agreement. Now, if it was, let's call it more of like a trade or like a corporate secret, trade secret non-disclosure agreement where maybe you're not giving out, business revenue or, something non-surveillance related, that would probably be an acceptable NDA. So the language of the ordinance is specific about what we're prohibiting.
Thank you so much. That's a great clarification.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So for every proposal, two items are required up front. The impact report, it's really the heart of this. It's where the thinking is supposed to occur, the mindfulness that we hope staff adopts and learns to operate under, that we're not just going to go release this equipment out to the wild. We need to understand it first. And these enumerated categories are required to be discussed. What comes out of that could inform the draft use policy that they're submitting to us at the same time. The use policy should be able to mitigate any of those concerns that are raised. And so they work together. One informs the other. There's another document on another slide we'll talk about in a second that will help clarify this a little bit more. But so these are the categories that are written into the ordinance. For every policy, for every proposal that's approved, there's an annual report. Each year they come back, they demonstrate how they use the equipment, and assuming everything goes well, they continue to use it. If not, it would probably most likely result in a policy modification rather than discontinuing use, although that is a possibility under the ordinance. Next slide, please. Yeah, so this is how it works. Staff would notify me that they, have a new proposal. We put them on the agenda. They give us the impact report and use policy, and we discuss it. They usually come to us cold. They give us their best first effort at it. We, chew it up. We usually go to a subcommittee, have some private meetings, sometimes with the vendors. That's been very helpful lately. It's not just staff, it's the actual vendor, which understands their equipment better than most of the staff. And then we'll come back for like a final vote after, a number of weeks or perhaps a month. And then usually, so far, we've always forwarded it to the council with a recommendation for approval based on the use policy we've drafted together. We have longer notice, 15 days here in El Poyan. Some of the other ordinances have up to 30 days of lead time. That's because they don't have a privacy commission. So we wanted a more public notice, a bite at the apple. Here with the privacy commission, plus the lead time, the council, I mean, folks are getting 3 to 4 months of lead time, so they can weigh in. And then the city council has to determine, based on the factors, based on a variety of factors, that the benefits of using this equipment outweigh the concern. And that includes fiscal, disparate impacts, efficacy, various metrics that we've written in there. And they have to determine that the use policy that we've created is going to safeguard the civil liberties and that there's no other reasonable alternative to use. And that's kind of it in a nutshell. And then, if it gets approved, and so far everything has, each year they return with an annual report. And so that's how we maintain oversight going forward. Yeah, so right now, just for whatever reason, I guess it's kind of a quirk of scheduling, we've been getting non-law enforcement proposals coming to us. DOT has quite a lot of surveillance, and this has actually been true in most of the jurisdictions I work in. They've got the cameras, they've got thermal imaging, they've got drones, they've got license plate readers, so they sometimes have the similar number of equipment as police departments. It's also been rather difficult in that these guys don't really know what questions to ask. They don't know what the concerns are. So there's been a lot of hand-holding. And we're going to discuss a questionnaire here in another slide that is designed to help this. But we've been working with the vendor and the staff getting their documents into shape. It's kind of reassuring in one sense. It's like they're so newbie or green that they don't even know how to be nefarious and misuse this equipment. But it's also clear that they just don't understand its potential for misuse. They don't understand the full capabilities. And that's the point of this ordinance. It's to make them do that research and to understand it before we go send it out into the wild and potentially impact people.
Could I ask you a question, please? This is Mayor Wheeler again. This is great. Have you completed your deliberations around drones, or is that still in process?
This is still in process. We'll probably be done. Our next meeting is coming up quickly, October 4. I think we've had this before us twice. We've had two meetings, and that includes maybe two more private meetings with just a small working group.
Very good. Thank you. And I wish you luck with that. It's a very thorny issue. And the second question I have is was this commission in place at the time that you evaluated and adopted body-worn cameras in your police bureau, or was that a decision that was made prior?
No, we were actually one of the early adopters for body-worn cameras. It was forced on us. We're in year 15 of federal monitoring, federal oversight, due to a consent decree. I'm sure you've heard all the problems the police department has. So we've actually had body cameras for a long time.
Okay.
We recently upgraded, and that use policy and the impact analysis will be coming before us probably around November.
And how long would you think, I'm asking you for completely selfish reasons, of course, how long would it take you to complete your analysis of that upgrade?
I think because we've had cameras for so long and because of the consent decree where we're forced to provide data and a lot of analysis has already occurred under court order, I think it'll actually be fairly quick, you know, 1 to 2 meetings at most.
Very good. I look forward to following your process, and thank you so much for participating today. We appreciate it up here.
Yes, and definitely happy to share any work product, any template, anything
you need. Can I jump in for a sec? It's Nick Fish.
Of course.
Number one, could we see a draft of your of the language that was used to prohibit non-disclosure agreements?
Yes.
And also, given that I understand the context of the context in which that arose, but it strikes me that concept may also have made it more complicated for Oakland to negotiate with Uber and Airbnb. Did the same principle guide your negotiation with these national companies that were insisting on non-disclosure of proprietary information?
Yeah, it's a one size fits all.
I'd love to see that language because you know cities across the country are still fighting to get certain data. And to have a policy that says we don't enter into non-disclosure agreements and accept at face value that the names of your hosts or your drivers is proprietary would be very interesting. So I'd be interested in if I could add to the list without overburdening you, just the specific language that was used in a city ordinance or resolution that established that principle, because I think it would be helpful to us to consider whether we want to do a similar policy.
Yes, I'll cut that language out.
Thank you.
After this.
So, Brian, thank you so much for your presentation and for your work in Oakland. It's been very helpful to follow, and you all have been just fantastically available to us and having conversations with us and helping us think about this. So we really appreciate it. I just want to wrap up sort of the official, our presentation piece. If Baird, did you have something you wanted to say before that?
No.
Okay, cool.
No, thank you.
So I'm going to talk just a little bit about opportunities and next steps. I think it's been a great conversation. You've asked really wonderful questions that are also have been questions that we've been going with. I think that adopting a set of a guidance or a set of principles that are based, are human rights based, looking at the rights of our community regarding privacy, is a great first step that then can help us guide policies as they come in. I think the places that we're going to have those tough conversations is not necessarily going to be in what those rights are or what we're committed to as government in our relationship with communities. I think the harder conversations are going to be when we have those competing interests that come up against each other. So I think in this day and age, we're just probably going to have to get good at those because I think we're going to have more and more of them. But there is a lot of great opportunity as well. And a couple of things I just wanted to point out was the some smart city projects in Columbus. They did a smart cities project because there's such a high disproportionate level of mortality for African-American mothers and their infants. And they put together a transportation support project to make sure that moms could get to their care providers throughout their pregnancy and make sure they were getting adequate care. Looking forward to hearing how that came across, how that works for people. There's a real opportunity for us to, I think the thing with the data, you know, we've had these conversations when the Coalition of Color, Communities of Color brought together the data they did in their initial report. When Urban League came forward with their State of Black Oregon, it really started to change the conversation in terms of our understanding of who's in our community, how are they faring, how do we need to think about making sure that we have opportunities for equity. And I think things like community-owned data is a very interesting concept for us to explore, and there are people who are thinking about that. I haven't had a chance to connect with them yet, but I've been given some names. In 30 years of listening to particularly to communities of color, what I've heard is we want to be believed, and we want you to prioritize our needs and interests because of the great historic disparity and marginalization. So this is an opportunity to think about how do we help folks get up in line for not only having vendors come and talk about what they can do to serve these communities, but how can our communities actually take advantage of those as wealth building opportunities? Because this field is going to grow and grow. And there's just a lot of things that I think are really important to think about, how we share information and how we use it. And so another big piece of this, I think, is figuring out where does the community voice sit in this. I really love what Oakland's done because it's an ongoing process because we know there are those sticky points. We need to have this lens. It's just like having an equity lens. What we would like to do moving forward is to develop a list of principles, rights, guidance that we would bring back to council for your approval that then would set sort of the framework as we move forward on these. The Office of Equity we're working collaboratively. We will convene community folks so that we know that they're engaged in this. And we are constantly having these conversations about demographics. What do we need to know? What do we want to know? And then what do we need to think about it? And another piece I just want to say is sometimes when we're talking about internal demographics of the workforce, one of the things I think about is we are also community members, but we have public service jobs. So we are all vulnerable in a kind of different way in terms of our lives and just thinking about the things. And as Commissioner Udaly brought up the piece where people take lots of different information and then get information about you. So it's something I've been raising as we think about what do we want to say about ourselves to the public and our jobs.
Judith, can I just respond to something you said earlier?
Yeah.
This is the first time that the council has received in a comprehensive fashion all this information about these privacy issues and public policy implications. And I want to be careful how this is interpreted, but I think it's premature for us to decide whether the Office of Equity and Human Rights sets the framework or whether we use a completely independent entity, a commission or some third party, because I'm not, the thing I've learned to my great detriment in this job is that until I understand what the goal is and where we want to end up, I'm loath to make those initial decisions about how we get on that path, because I want to understand comprehensively what's our plan. And so I'm going to throw a little cold water on just the concept of one bureau being tasked, and the Office of Equity in particular being tasked with this, until we've had a little time to have a conversation about what's our ultimate goal. And I think we need to have a broader discussion as a council before we launch even a principle setting thing, because those principles, depending on who helps establish them and who's on the table, end up shaping lots of things. And I have a lot more questions than answers right now based on the presentation, so I just want to put that marker down.
And I just want to say, Commissioner, I may have misspoken in a way that gave you the impression that our bureau would be in charge of this. That's not the intention. I'm on the Smart City Steering Committee. We're working collaboratively together. There's a lot of things that are moving forward with smart cities that we really do need to establish some just some guidelines. So it's really part of the Smart Cities Initiative, what we have done in our partnership and in the work the three of us have done collaboratively is to agree over the next month or two to lend support to getting public involvement engaged with some of this. At the end of the month, we're going to have someone from Seattle come down. We're talking about having some kind of a community event where we can have a panel discussion so we can actually have this kind of briefing for the community as well. So I think I gave a wrong impression if I gave the impression that our office would solely be leading this.
Well, your
effort.
Office may very well be. I'm agnostic as to who does what. I am very taken with the idea of setting up an independent commission that provides some guidance. And an independent commission may actually be the best suited to do community engagement, advised by the Office of Equity and others, rather than us doing it, given the general levels of trust that these issues elicit in the community. So just food for thought.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that too, Commissioner, although an independent commission would still be staffed by a particular bureau. So, and as you pointed out earlier, the Office of Equity and Human Rights is one of those bureaus that it has a responsibility per code to talk to all members of the council, not just their commissioner in charge. So I was thinking also of, do we need another commission? We've got a Technology Oversight Committee. That's not the same. Human Rights Commission, a revitalized Bureau Advisory Committee within the Office of Equity and Human Rights. There's various ways to staff such an effort. I was feeling really happy that this conversation is now broader than just transportation. And I think that there has in the past been a tendency to think that smart cities is just about getting the traffic lights right or, you know, whatever. And this makes it very clear that it is across all bureaus. And so we do need to figure out what's the appropriate way to engage community members in telling us, I do want that or I don't want that.
And I just want to be clear. Commissioner Fritz just tied a perfect bow on this conversation, and I know that we could go on and on and on, but we're 10 minutes over and I want to be respectful of everybody's time. Could I just ask one quick question? Is this protecting data, protecting residents? Is this homework?
That's on you.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, yes, you have two, actually you have two articles. One is that's a white paper from the Sunlight Foundation. The other one is actually a chapter written by Kelsey around privacy and smart cities.
Very
so
good.
It's for you, for your staff, so we can actually start deeper conversations.
Great. Anything else for the good of the order?
Yeah, I'd like to make a closing comment.
Please.
First, I'd just like to thank you for this presentation as the newly appointed commissioner in charge of PBOT, the most common association I have so far with smart cities is autonomous vehicles. So I'm really excited to be sitting here and thinking about all the other potentials for this information, and the fact that we can't let private industry set our agenda, our priorities, our values. We need to prioritize what's best for our residents and our city, and the best way to do that is to engage with them. And it's not necessarily autonomous vehicles. In fact, I can almost guarantee that it's not, the priority is not going to be autonomous vehicles when we bring this to the public. Very interested in community-owned data and privacy, and I've just been taking copious notes and looking up books already that I need to read in order to get up to speed. So thank you for the presentation.
Great. Excellent work, all of you. Thank you. We're adjourned.
Data is Goliath, is the first one.